Building the fashion businesses of the future together. Welcome to the future of fashion business. The future of fashion business is about helping aspiring fashion entrepreneurs and designers start their own successful fashion brands by learning from the best, most experienced people in the industry. I am your host, Esteban Julian. For more advice and to learn more about how I started my own fashion brand, make sure you follow my fashion journey on YouTube at Esteban Julian. Hello, and welcome to this week's episode of The Future of Fashion Business. I am your host, Esteban Julian. And on this week's episode, I sat down with Melanie Smallwood. Melanie is the International Buying Director at Global Fashion Group. Global Fashion Group is a leading fashion and lifestyle destination in more than 15 countries. They're responsible for connecting over 10,000 brands to the international marketplace. So we were very, very lucky to have Melanie sit down and talk to us about everything that she's done in the industry to get to where she is at right now. And not only that, we covered a lot of very, very interesting topics, including what type of products you should be offering, why you should expand the products that you're offering to your customers, and most importantly, a question that everybody has when they're starting the fashion brand, which is, how much should I actually charge for my products? Very, very good episode. We recommend you sit down, take some notes, and hope you enjoy this week's episode. That being said, let's get to the episode. Melanie, thank you for being here today. Again, I'm glad we can both agree on how terrible the weather is being in London. Just for you guys that are not in this country at the moment, I promise that you guys are not missing out on much. Am I right?
Absolutely. Although London is a fabulous city, it's just not the most optimal from a weather perspective at the moment.
Exactly. It is from a fashion perspective. It definitely isn't from a weather perspective.
Exactly.
Awesome. Awesome, Melanie. Well, to start off, again, thank you very much for being here today. I really want to ask you and want people out there in homes or in their jobs or commuting to work to know a little bit more about your personal story in the industry, because you've been in the industry for 25 years plus, right?
Yeah, far too long if you ask many people.
So can you give us a little bit more background on how your story has happened pretty much?
Sure. So I started my career 25 plus years ago as a buyer at Harrods. I was working within the women's wear area at Harrods and also did some buying within kids. And I was there for 15 years, broadly speaking, across multiple different roles and different parts of the business. And my last role there was assistant fashion director, which meant that I got to be involved in a lot of strategy and direction and the evolution of the Harrods women's wear and weigh-in business, which was super cool. My father was actually one of the original buyers for weigh-in in 1964. So we have a bit of a family legacy around Harrods. So I was pretty happy to be establishing my career there. But after 15 years, I was thinking about what next. You know, buying and merch is something that I love and where I've been successful, but I wanted to think about learning and developing my role and my skill set. So I had an opportunity through my network to go and work for the licensee for Harvey Nichols in Saudi Arabia. They have a fabulous store in Riyadh that's been around since 2000, and they were in some challenging situations in regard to the business, and they were trying to run a lot of it remotely. And, you know, the cultural challenges that happen in that market, trying to manage a fashion business which is predominantly female is somewhat difficult. So I took on the challenge and was running that business for 5 years as a buying director across women's, kids, men's, shoes, accessories, and loved it. Did a good turnaround job on that business. It's a luxury business, so the skill set was already there from a experience perspective, but in terms of the demographic and the customer base that we were working with was entirely different. And kids wear is a huge opportunity in that market because there are a lot of children per household in Riyadh. So spent 5 years there. And then I think my husband challenged me to be at home a little more frequently because I was traveling all the fashion markets and then spending a lot of time in on the ground in Riyadh. And I got approached about a job running the what they call fashion category at eBay. And that was a pretty big business. eBay, as you know, is a $70 billion business back then. So my rationale was I've done pretty much 20 years of bricks and mortar buying and merch and retailing. How do I go about learning digital? Because e-commerce was evolving rapidly and businesses were clearly needing to understand that skill set in a lot more detail. So I challenged myself to go and work for a company that, from a fashion perspective, was a massive deviation for me from the luxury market that I'd been operating in, but required me to learn a new skill set around online and in many instances, fast fashion, so different segmentations. And I did that for 5 years. I ran their fashion category for the UK and Germany and enjoyed it thoroughly, but missed being close to product. And ultimately, that's what drove me back into a pure fashion e-com business. And I now work for a company called Global Fashion Group, where I've been for just under 4 years. And we operate fashion e-commerce platforms in international markets, so key growth markets. So another learning and development opportunity, because we're operating in Latin America, in Asia Pacific, and in Russia CIS. So the logic and the way we operate is very similar to other fashion e-coms in developed markets, but we have a lot of complexity through how our countries have evolved and how developed they are from an online perspective. So I'm the international buying director for this business, which is across 17 countries and 10,000 brands. So it keeps me out of mischief and keeps me constantly learning, and that's where I am. That's where my 25 years has stacked up to now.
I mean, well, it's stacked up to quite a bit, Melanie, let me tell you that. And I can definitely see how having such, well, I guess, odd changes in terms of the companies that you were working for led to the skill set that you have today. Because, I mean, to start off, you said you went to Asia to work for Harvey Nichols, which I'm sure gave you a lot of information, a lot of background, and made you very educated on the Asian market, which then nowadays turned into one of the biggest luxury markets out there. Plus then your experience in eBay right before, you know, digital retailers really started going for it.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely, I think the combination of skill set is really critical in this market now. And I think when I first decided to move from Harvey Nichols to eBay, a lot of my peer group were challenging me a lot on the decision. But fundamentally, there's a lot of learning to be had through e-com and how it's developed and how it works for fashion. And it's, you know, there are commonalities between bricks and mortar and e-com, but there are equally other challenges to deal with. So it's definitely been good for me, and I would encourage anybody coming into the industry to think more omni-channel than purely, you know, straight bricks and mortar, or to pigeonhole themselves into one particular area of expertise, because it does limit you for the future.
100%. Now, because, and I don't know if you're aware of this, because my audience tends to be, yes, we do have a couple of fashion executives out there, but most of the people that follow my podcast are people that are either, you know, wanting to start their own fashion businesses or just barely starting their own fashion business. They're not too advanced when it comes to where their business is at. So I really want to get your take, because obviously I know you have an expertise in fashion buying, on and get sort of your opinion, your perspective on how independent fashion designers that are starting out can successfully start having, you know, things like knowing how to price their products, how to know which product should be they even be offering in the first place. So just to start everything out, why do you think, and this is for people that don't even know what a product offering is, why do you think product offering and having the right amount, not only of good products, but the right diversity of products is such a big influence on sales or on revenue?
I think that the reality for people starting out is a lot of the product that is available is filling a market need and a market demand. So I think for people coming into the business newly or developing ranges or thinking about launching fashion businesses, the primary focus is product. Product and customer drive everything from a success criterion perspective. So having the right product at the right price is key to engaging with your customer and driving loyalty through that customer base. And I think identifying what your product offering or range needs to look like is very critical. So very often the best startups in fashion are born out of somebody frustrated by not being able to find a product that solves a problem for them. And developing a product that solves that issue for them that is also likely to be an issue for many other consumers out there. So I think from that perspective, it's key that you identify what you're solving for. And it's key that you identify that there is a gap in the market for that product or that range. And then I think a lot of the other challenges around positioning and pricing and making sure that you clearly identify who your target customer is for that product. So I think all of those components together will create a perfect storm, in essence, of engaging your customers, selling at the right price, and delivering a great product. Quality is absolutely fundamental. People don't care whether it's a fast fashion product or whether it's a luxury product. If the quality is not good relative to the price, it can be a very significant distraction for customers.
Awesome. So pretty much make sure that the quality of your product is amazing, that you're showing and you're putting your product in front of the right customers, the ones that, as you said, are your targeted market, and make sure that that product is being offered at the right price, right?
Exactly.
Awesome. Now, is there any sort of very common problems that you think people make, especially starting out when it comes to this product and market mix?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people, there are two problems that I see relatively frequently. One is people designing product purely for themselves and not thinking broadly about their target customer. And the other thing is designing product ranges that are too narrow. So not offering a cohesive range of products. Definitely in the first few seasons, because the way that great fashion businesses evolve is by testing and learning their way through and finding their DNA through their product. So if you launch a product range which is very narrow, you're actually going to limit your ability to clearly identify what your brand and your product DNA should be from a consumer perspective. So customers are a great benchmark in terms of what's resonating from a range perspective, product, and from a pricing perspective. But to get a real read, you need to have a cohesive range. I'm not suggesting that you need to be a Mango or a fast fashion brand that has thousands of SKUs, but you definitely need to create something that could be put together as a range and presented in a cohesive manner, whether it's in a bricks and mortar environment or online.
Amazing. And would you recommend people start off having, as you said, a diverse product offering, even though they haven't really proven the concept of their brand? Or should they start with one very simple product that, again, might represent the space or the opportunity in the marketplace that they found? Or should they just try and get as many products as quickly as possible?
In my opinion, you should have a range or a selection of products to test and learn your way through the market. I think if you have a single product, it's very hard to get a read on how successful that could be. So you need to have some associated products that are linked in terms of DNA, but perhaps do a different thing. So it's the classic range planning topic where you need to have tops to bottom ratios, and you need to have, for fashion specifically, you need to have something that the customer can create a look and put together something that's cohesive that they can buy into that lifestyle and that product range. I think one product is very difficult to present in a considered way. And I think you just don't get the response from the customers that you need to understand better what you should or shouldn't be developing.
Mm-hmm. Especially in luxury, in something like luxury, right, where communication and branding is so important. If you limit yourself to only one product, then you're automatically limiting the communication of your brand that you could be communicating otherwise. Because again, you don't have the amount of product to show them what your brand actually stands for, right?
Absolutely. And people buy into brands. They buy into DNA. They buy into a lifestyle. And especially in luxury, if you present one product. I mean, there's an argument around a limited edition and supply and demand topic, but that's starting out. That's not where you're at. You need to create it can be a small range. You know, there are a lot of young accessory designers out there that create a range of 25 products. It doesn't need to be massively cash intensive to do that, but it does need to be something that buyers and people can look at and go, wow, I get it. I understand what you're doing, and I understand who this is for, and I understand what your brand DNA is across the different products, because they all have to connect as well. So I think that's really important, especially in luxury, because the pricing architecture in luxury, it means the customer may only buy across 20% of what you're presenting, but I think it also gives you a much better chance of being successful.
Amazing. And for those, what would you think would be the least recommendable amount of products to launch if you don't have specifically the financial resources to, you know, invest in a full collection?
I mean, I think anything less than sort of 25 options is challenging, because I just don't think you'll get engagement from people to see it. Mm-hmm. So for me, that would be, and it depends, you know, if it's a ready-to-wear range, then that probably needs to double. But if it's accessories range, probably around the 25. For jewelry, you could probably go slightly lighter. But again, depends on whether it's fine jewelry or whether it's, you know, a slightly more premium or luxury level. So I think it's very much determined by the category in which you're presenting the range as well.
And now, we'd like to take a quick commercial break to thank our sponsors. This podcast is sponsored by Your Social Component. At Your Social Component, we help fashion and e-commerce business owners automate and scale their online sales using the best online advertising strategies out there. If you're looking for a marketing agency that completely understands your industry and can scale your fashion and e-commerce business to the next level, make sure you get in touch through our website at yoursocialcomponent.com. Now let's continue with this week's episode. Awesome. And let's say somebody finally, you know, they think they have, or they found a gap in the marketplace, because I'm trying to understand how, or I want people to sort of understand how they can lower their risk when they're starting a brand like this. Now, going back to what you said at the beginning, that in order to see if there is a market for your product, that you should analyze your own story, your own life, and see what would you like a brand to be offering and try to do something that nobody else is doing. But how can you verify that with the actual marketplace? What's the smart way to go about it? Because, you know, a lot of people might be super avant-garde, and they really have this idea that might be very unique, very, very special. But at the end of the day, the market's not, it's not there for that idea. What's the easiest way to verify that without having to, you know, launch a full collection and spend all this time and all these resources developing a full collection when the marketplace wasn't even there to begin with?
I think it's a tough one. I think a lot of competitive analysis is key. You know, benchmarking your products against other competitors and brands that are out there. I think buyers will give you a very candid view on product, but that does require you to create a sample set, which costs money. It doesn't require you to create, you know, volume of product, but I think that's almost the best way to do it. But I think it's really hard without physical product samples to get a really good response. I mean, you can do a lot around PR and marketing and present the idea and the mood boards and the, you know, the brand position to people. But fundamentally in this industry, it's a product-driven industry, so people will want to see samples. So you know, my guidance would be, if at all possible, to create a one set of samples that you then take to either, you know, the smaller independent trade shows, or you take to people in the industry that can advise you on product and price and quality and give you really constructive feedback around the direction you're taking. You can also do it conceptually and create mood boards and a range plan, but the product is a living, breathing piece, and that does tend to be how people respond better. So if at all possible, from an investment perspective, my advice would be to create something tangible that people can touch and feel and see and clearly understand what you're trying to achieve.
Awesome. And when it comes to, you know, offering different types of products, there's so many different types of products that you could offer. You know, there's accessories, there's bags, there's purses, there's dresses. I mean, there's just such a large amount of product that you could potentially be offering. What's the best way to learn or to know what sort of products you should expand into offering?
So I think, again, it depends on the type of channels that you're thinking about. If you're thinking about an e-commerce proposition, accessories are a very good product category, because they're not what we call a considered purchase in many instances. So depending on the price positioning, accessories are highly demanded. So in fact, in terms of launching a new brand or a new product, accessories is definitely where a lot of people start to build their ranges from. From an apparel perspective, I mean, dresses is a category that is very dominant across all segments of the industry. We know that dresses is one of the highest uptakes from a category perspective, certainly for us. And you don't need to necessarily create a collection or a clothing collection that does dresses, t-shirts, denim, jackets, the whole caboodle. You could just create a range that's very unique that services a, you know, a demand around fabulous dresses for certain occasions or for certain customers. And I think those are the things that you have to build from a small base. Mm-hmm. And then if that's successful, then you add new elements and you continue to build the range that way. Accessories is definitely from a starting out perspective, a very logical and sensible category. Jewelry is more difficult because, you know, it's one of those things where you do need to create a much bigger range to some degree to get traction. But accessories, as I said before, you can create a smaller range and create something that's very compelling to both the customers and the buyers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because the production from accessories is just a lot simpler, right? You don't have to worry about different sizes. The return rates are a lot smaller. It's not something that people have to try on. They can just see it and purchase it, especially if you're doing something digitally, as you said.
Exactly. And, you know, the volumes are also lower. So your minimums will be lower than they would be for an apparel product. So also from a starting out perspective, accessories, you can negotiate lower minimums normally with factories. If you're producing in Europe, you can sometimes piggyback off production. So, you know, dresses, you start to get into blocks and you start to get into quite significant minimums, and you're then competing with a hell of a lot more people from a manufacturing perspective. So it's definitely tougher, I would say. So accessories for me is strategically quite a sensible starting out point.
Awesome. Awesome. And do you think the same principles of product offering apply to retail and physical, you know, physical direct-to-consumer sales, or is it a little bit different or more flexible digitally, or is it exactly the same, just as important, and the same products have to be offered both digitally and physically, if possible, of course?
I think if you can offer the same range across those digital channel and the bricks and mortar channels, that's ideal. What is really important to understand is that within the digital channels, you get a much quicker read. So customers are responding very, very fast, whereas in a bricks and mortar environment, you know, there's a question of presenting the brand, making sure the customers are aware of it. Online, you know, the customer gets to search and gets to see what's top of mind for them, so they respond very quickly. So you can often get a better read on online So my guidance would always be to try and do both in parallel, but expect your learnings to be much faster in a digital environment than they would be in a bricks and mortar.
Amazing. Amazing. Now, Melanie, I'm going to take full advantage that that I happen to have a buying director on this podcast for, of such a big company. So I know we've covered a lot on product offering, which I think is something that people don't know enough about, especially people starting out. And I also want to cover one of probably the biggest questions that people have starting out. One of the questions that probably make them procrastinate or not start their own things because they just don't know how to respond to this question themselves. And that is pricing. Okay. Mm-hmm. Specifically, and you know, the luxury sector where pricing is something that can be a lot scarier to work with since you the numbers that you're offering for that you're asking for your products are, you know, exponentially higher than something like fast fashion. So what is, and this, I know this will be a very general question, so it will be hard to give a solid specific answer to, but what's the most efficient way for somebody starting out to actually start pricing a product?
It's a million-dollar question, that one, because I don't think anybody has an exact formula. What I would say is that you need to figure out what the real value of the product is to the customer. So that's almost the starting point. And, you know, there are a lot of great luxury brands that will help you in terms of indicative pricing. So you can benchmark your product, whether it's an accessory or apparel product, against what other luxury players are doing in terms of price positioning. You'll see in the luxury market, there's from a category by category basis. If you exclude the likes of a Chanel or an Hermes, there's the fairly consistent segmentation in pricing around what people are willing to pay for a luxury handbag versus, you know, a beautiful dress. So I think that's doing that market research principally in the first instance is a really good litmus test of where you should be positioning your product. Then you have to take into consideration that you're not a widely known brand, so your brand equity will be lower, so you need to adjust your pricing accordingly. And then the reality is you also need to then work back to what you're paying for that product from your supply chain. And you need to, in order to build a scalable business, you need to be profitable. So you need to almost take into consideration and work back from what retail price you think this product should be, and then work it back to what is the price that you should be paying your supply chain for the manufacturing of that particular product. And I think customer first is always my advice, because the customers are king pretty much everywhere. And you need to position yourself in the right way to engage the customers, because it doesn't matter how beautiful your product is. If your pricing architecture is overstated, dependent on brand equity and quality, the customer will just not engage with your brand. So I think the primary guidance is, where are you positioning yourself? And if it's luxury, at what end of luxury? Is it affordable luxury? So if you look at the Michael Kors and you look at the DKNYs of the world, they've been very smart in adjusting their pricing to engage with a broader customer base, because they are not considered high-level luxury brands. So it's looking at where you fit in the jigsaw puzzle or the landscape of luxury brands and how you want to be positioned. And then you adjust the pricing architecture marginally to offset the fact that you are a new brand to market. So people will not necessarily pay a premium to buy the product.
Mm-hmm. Amazing. And then again, and this is a question that I have actually personally, because I don't actually know the answer to this one myself. People are usually very afraid that, again, if they price their product wrong, that will be like sort of like the end of it, that you cannot adapt your pricing based on what you learn. As you said, if you don't have the brand power to even though you have the quality and you have the margins that allow you to price your product at a certain price, you don't have the brand backing the price up. So you might want to start pricing it at a little bit lower range. But there's this sort of there's this sort of conflict in between, what if I lower my prices, will my brand suffer for it? Or can I just lower my prices to have an easier barrier of entry? And then as sales starts kicking in, as I develop a relationship with my customers, can I start increasing the price? Because I think that's what most people are afraid of, right? Back to what you said, that the customer is the most important thing. A lot of people are afraid that if they start by pricing their brand not to the potential that they wanted to price it at, then all of a sudden they increase their pricing because, you know, they need the highest net profits, or they want people to relate to associate their brand with a luxury brand. They're too afraid to go for that because they're afraid their customers will be disappointed for it. What's your take on that?
I think it's an interesting one. My view is that you would find it very challenging as a new brand or business to go in at a certain price position and then increase it, because the customer is very savvy now, and they are very clear about how they shop, and they compare prices for comparable brands. And, you know, the evolution of e-com and online has made it much harder for brands in that regard. So I would say that it's much, in my opinion, and it's only my opinion, start where you think you should be, and then if anything, just down. I wouldn't advise on going low to secure business per se and then adjusting up, because I think customers become disengaged. And you want ultimately, when building a new brand, is customer loyalty, and you want people to engage with your brand and be advocates for your brand, so that they're telling their friends that they bought this amazing product and it was this very cool price. So I think price is extremely critical from the get-go. So from the initial stages, you need to do a lot of homework around positioning and who you want to be. And there are a couple of brands that I've seen in the last however many years that have overstated their pricing and adjusted their pricing down very successfully, because they're actually filling a gap in the market for affordable luxury, because not everybody can afford to spend £2,500-£3,000 on a handbag. But if that handbag is sub £1,000, suddenly it becomes a little bit more accessible. So for me, the key is that, rather than increasing pricing over time, because I think people, certainly customers, get switched off by that, at least in my experience.
Absolutely. Awesome. And do you think, because people tend to think that the bigger the margins when it comes to the products that you're selling, the better. But is that generally true in all scenarios? Like, the more and the higher you try to go for your margins, is it better, or is it not always the case?
It's not always the case. I think, you know, to build a long-term sustainable business, you have to have a margin that across all of your products makes sense and that you're making profit. But if you do the high margin game from the get-go, the reality is it won't be sustainable. You can improve your margins through volume growth with your supply chain. So my advice and counsel would always be to work to a margin that means you're profitable. And then as you build and scale your business, your margins will improve fairly organically through your volume scale. And you can achieve a blended margin across different products. So some products are cheaper to manufacture. You can source them in certain countries where it's easier to bring in products at a better price. So you offset a slightly higher margin on one product, but then you may have to take a little bit of a smaller margin with another product that's more premium, that's perhaps manufactured in Italy or somewhere in Europe. So the important thing is that you almost look at it on a product by product basis, and you end up with a blended margin that enables you to be profitable, so that you have enough working capital in the business, but doesn't overstate the margin and lead you to a place that's just not sustainable in the long term.
Awesome. Yeah. Not to mention that, going back to what you said about the importance of transparency, nowadays people will end up finding out. And if your customers find out that you're overcharging them for a product, or that you're not being honest and transparent with everything that's going on with, when it comes to the product that you're selling to them, as you said, it's not going to be sustainable.
No. And there are a lot of, you know, you're in a very competitive industry across every market. So there is always an alternative solution if you're not, you know, being transparent and positioning the product in the right way at the right price, which means the right margin.
Wow, that's incredible. Now, I think we've covered pretty much all of it, because I mean, people tend to think about pricing, as I said, of this behemoth that they don't really, they're too afraid to like give a try out of, or to start actually developing for their products. But as you said, I think that the most important thing is that they do a lot of market research. As you said at the beginning of the episode, look at what the competitors are doing, so you have some sort of idea. And most important thing is to focus on your product. Because if your product is worthy, if the quality behind your product is great, if the story behind your product is amazing, nowadays, you know, if it's sustainable and it has all these features and benefits to it that allow you to price it higher, then there's no reason why you should have an unsustainable profit margin if you have the product to back it up, right?
Absolutely. And there are things that drive engagement with customers. You know, you mentioned sustainability. People will pay a premium for products that are created in a sustainable way. Doesn't mean that you have to be completely vegan or you have to go completely that in that direction, because that naturally makes it more expensive. But if you can add value in other ways through your supply chain and your factory base by creating unique components of your product that allow you to add a little bit of premium in the pricing, then that's also something to think about, because people now are really rebelling against this low value, you know, high turnover, fast fashion products. They're definitely more considered in how they think about fashion. And the millennials and the younger consumer base, which is who we tend to you know, be heavily entrenched with, are very, very conscious of where the product has come from and how it's been sourced and how it's been produced, and the whole kind of ethical trading and sustainable topics are top of mind for them. So definitely something to think about in terms of how you develop your product. It's more about quality rather than quantity, in my view.
Amazing. And I mean, I guess this actually leaves me with one very interesting question as well, is what if you, over time, you start adding features to your original product that, again, are going to make it more valuable? Let's say you found a way to make the bags that you were selling sustainable or vegan or something. Could you then increase the pricing for that certain product if you present it as a new product entirely with those new features and benefits?
Absolutely. I think if it's clearly articulated that that's what you've done, and you know, there's a premium for those additional features, customers are very open to that. What they don't want to see is the same product just increase pricing because, you know, of volume requirements or whatever positioning topics. So if it has a valid rationale behind it, and there's clearly a positive upside to buying that product now because it's sustainable or it has components of sustainability, people will take that into consideration. But the really fundamental key to that is communication with the customer and making sure that they understand why that pricing has changed.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Now, Melanie, a lot of incredible value. I know for sure I've learned a lot with this episode. I want to end the episode before we actually dive into the last actual question of the episode. There's one that I would really like to have your opinion on, and this is something that just came up, and it's a topic that I enjoy talking about because these sort of fashion companies are tended to be considered sort of like unicorns. And this will go back to when we were talking about product offering. How would you, or what would be your take on, because I know obviously streetwear is not where you developed your expertise in, but I'm very interested on to listen what you have to say. Why would you think that brands like, and for example, Supreme now has a very broad product offering, but there's been a lot of streetwear brands in particular that have started out with a couple of products, maybe even one product. There's a very famous brand called Anti-Social Club or something like Yeezy from Kanye West, which pretty much started again with just shoes. What do you think determined the success for those brands while having such a limited product offering?
I think it's an interesting one, right? Because streetwear has evolved massively. I mean, and I think that's also born out of the way the industry has shifted and the customer has shifted, because the, you know, in my Harrods days, everybody was dressing very formally and they were buying designer brand top to toe, and they would never deviate. If they were buying Gucci, they were buying Gucci shoes and all the way up to the hats if they could. So I think the shift change has happened through social media predominantly. And I think the evolution of influencers like Yeezy and other really important people in, not in fashion industry specifically, but in the music industry and the entertainment industry, who have a very strong target audience, they buy into the products because they buy into that individual and the lifestyle of that individual. So I think that's where you can limit the number of products. There's also a massive supply and demand play going on with these guys. You know, they could, like Supreme, you know, they've broadened the product range a lot now, but, you know, a lot of it you see through sneaker brands where they, you know, they issue a limited edition something, which is endorsed by an influencer. And there are, you know, we're based in near Carnaby Street, and there are some amazing stores, and you can see that they get this invite only, and then there are queues of people around the block queuing up for their one of 200 pairs of Nike whatevers. So I think that's where the success of that has come from. You know, the new guards and the businesses that are using influencers and celebrities to create product and merch are very smart. It's not, in my opinion, scalable in the long term. I think it's very much a current trend, and I'll be interested to see how those collections evolve and if they become broader and bigger and, you know, become more sustainable from a commercial perspective. But they certainly, they're very smart around marketing and using social media to drive influence, and therefore conversion on their products is very high. So it's also a target audience that's relatively young. Very much today driven by what's happening on Instagram, what, you know, what's the cool thing from a community perspective as well. Who's cool, who's wearing the right stuff, who's promoting it, who's the coolest music producer and things like that. So I think it's an interesting one. I'm not sure how big these brands will and what the longevity of these brands is. For me, it's very much a moment in time, I think, in the industry. But it's an exciting time for sure.
It is, and very, very different. That's why I always like to talk about these companies, because they definitely are doing something that has not been seen before. And so that's why it's always interesting for me to hear the take of people like you, because it's something that, again, breaks the things that people usually hear about. But that being said, Melanie, I really appreciate you being on this episode today. There's going to be one more question before we wrap this whole thing up. And it's a question that I really like to ask all of my guests. And that question is, you know, if you could go back 25 years ago, you know, you're just starting in the fashion industry, what would be the best piece that you'd give yourself, and why?
There's probably two pieces of advice. Get a great mentor. Find somebody in the industry that you can seek counsel from, because you will never always make the right decision. And the best piece of advice that I still live by today, 25 years on, and I shared the same piece of advice with my teenage daughter very recently, was do a job that you love and you're passionate about. And if you ever stop loving what you're doing, change your job, change your industry. Fashion is a tough industry to get into, and it's a tough industry to be in, and it's very competitive. And I think just loving what you do and being able to get up every day and be enthusiastic and motivated and passionate about what you do for a living is fundamental to how well you'll do it. That's probably the only piece of wisdom that I would give myself back in the day. And then the other one, which is a very interesting one that my father told me when I started out, was be respectful and professional to everybody. So the lady that makes the tea, the delivery guy, the warehouse guy, because someday they may be somewhere and someone that you need to do business with.
Awesome. Love it. Love it. Well, Melanie, thank you very much for this episode. A lot of very, very valuable information. I'm sure my audience is also very, very happy with everything that we discussed today. So I can't thank you enough for being here with us today.
It's my pleasure. It's been great. Thank you so much, Julian.
If you want to learn even more about how you can start your own fashion brand, make sure you follow me on YouTube at Esteban Julian. Thank you for listening to this week's episode of The Future of Fashion Business. Make sure you subscribe to listen to our future episodes.